Hiberno Goethe, German-Irish Conversations. Join me, St. Pauli fan and former Dusseldorfer, Ciarán Murray, in conversation with my guests as we explore the connecting moments of German and Irish life. We delve into the many aspects of arts, language and life across cultures. What do musicians, dancers, artists and writers pick up from both cultures? And how are they inspired and enriched by the other? Hiberno Goethe. German-Irish Conversations is for all listeners who like to go and think beyond borders. This podcast is supported by the Goethe Institute Dublin. Willkommen, Falche, and welcome to the first official programme. My guest this time is mezzo-soprano singer Sharon Carty. Sharon has lived and worked in Germany, Austria and in Ireland, of course, but more of that anon. Sharon, I first want to ask you about being an opera singer. When did you know that you were going to, or did you always know when you were a little girl, did you know that you were going to be an opera singer?
No, not at all. I don't even know if I don't know now if I have one. No, I am one of actually very many opera singers who kind of have an unconventional route into it. When I was a little girl, I was a big tomboy, so I was always out in the street playing football with the lads and stuff. And it was only through my secondary school music teacher, a lovely woman called Aideen Lane, who was also an opera singer herself. And so I guess she knew the ins and outs of the job. And then she went into teaching after it. She kind of pulled me out in first year and said, "You sing Away in a Manger at the Christmas concert in front of the whole school." And I couldn't understand. Like, I played fiddle and piano and was always good at doing the descant and stuff in primary school. I could kind of hold the tune, so they used to give that to me. But no one had ever made any sort of a comment about my actual singing voice being something that could have, I suppose, been trained into being an opera singer. And yeah, so I sang Away in a Manger age 12 in front of all of the school, and my mum taught in the school as well, so it was mortifying. And I had no interest in singing. I didn't like the attention of, you know, kind of facing an audience. I played the piano and I loved that. And she used to keep giving me, like, you know, old LPs and stuff of Janet Baker, who's probably the greatest English mezzo-soprano of the last kind of 100 years. And I remember, you know, for my junior cert, listening to her and being like, "Oh God, that's so wobbly. I never want to sing like that." And now if someone says, "Oh, I heard a little, you know, element of Janet Baker in your singing," I'm like, yes.
Wobbly, is that an official operatic term? If you hear that voice, can you use that? Is that?
Oh, the vibrato. Yeah. Vibrato is, yeah, it's how much the sound wave vibrates, I suppose. And as an opera singer, as a classically trained singer, you have to aim for something in the middle, that it's not too straight a tone, because, you know, singing is a sound wave, to be kind of technical about it, so it obviously has a Schwellungen.
I just want to get the inside track, so I'll sound like I know what I'm talking about. If I say wobbly to opera singers, will they be happy with that?
It's not a technical term that I would advise using.
What about at home? Did you come from a home where there was lots of opera and lots of music?
Lots of music, but not lots of opera. The predominant musical taste was my dad's country and western music. So Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings, as we used to slag him, Wailing Jennings, which we hated it so much. My dad absolutely adored it. But no classical music. So none of us can figure out where that came from at all.
And since you've become so educated in music, have you been more... have you got a better appreciation for Tammy Wynette and Wailing Jennings?
Yeah, that, to be fair, yeah. Okay. I mean, I think Willie Nelson has an absolutely incredible voice. I don't think there's anyone else on the planet who sings like him. I would definitely say that I've kind of been more tolerant of other styles.
I thought you were going to say no, funny enough. Is it easy to appreciate ordinary pop music, or does it seem more trivial to you?
That's a good question. I mean, which actually came into my head last week for some reason. I mean, there's pop music and there's pop music. I think the pop music today is utter rubbish, if I'm honest. There's no imagination in melodies. It's all just repetition of words and stuff. But when you look at things like, you know, Freddie Mercury and Queen and ABBA or the Beatles, which is pop music, and they didn't have auto-tune to kind of correct faults in tuning, so they had to be on top of their game musically and vocally. So older pop music, yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. I wouldn't have an awful lot of time for the pop music that's written now, apart from kind of bopping along in a disco. Like,
what about German? What was your when was your first encounter with German?
My first encounter with German was actually in sixth class. I'd forgotten that actually. We had the opportunity to do an hour a week after school in sixth class, so I did it then. And then again in secondary school, it all goes back to having wonderful teachers, really. When I was in first year, we did all the subjects that were offered for junior cert. There was like 12 or 13 of them, and then you chose going into secondary. So I did French and German, and I remember our absolutely beautiful teacher, Sister Marie Therese, and she was a nun, and she had been to France and Germany and had worked over there and kind of taught over there in both countries, and she was our teacher for both, and she was so elegant and she loved the languages, and she had like wonderful enunciation for both languages. And I remember I got 85% in my summer exams in both languages, because I kind of wanted some sort of like scientific way to ascertain which one I should go for. And I chatted with her about it, and she said, I think you probably would do better in German, because I've always been quite logically minded, and I like understanding there's lots of rules in German, but that's kind of its beauty in another way, because if you learn all of the grammar tables and the prepositions and all that kind of stuff, there's very few times when there are exceptions to the rules, so it's really clear, whereas with like English or French there's silent letters and exceptions. Mm-hmm. And
so did you learn der, die, das, die, den, die, das, die,
dem,
des,
dem, dem, des, der, des, der? Yes, I did. I hated it at the time, actually, but like in hindsight, when I went kind of when I was in Austria and Germany properly, then I was so grateful that was like seared into my brain, because you could just call it up immediately and like see the grid in your head. And then the difficult thing became knowing what the gender of the noun is, because that's just like, oh God.
What about, do you remember at school, were there German poems on, or was there any German writers, or did that appear?
No, actually, I don't. Oh God, that's a good question. I think it was mostly focused on the oral stuff, you know, talking about yourself and your family with the oral exam and kind of reading comprehension. Maybe I'll be proven wrong. I don't have any recollection of doing any literature.
It's kind of an unfair question, I suppose, because I was a German teacher and there wasn't any literature or poetry on.
It was so I remember
grammar.
Correctly.
I remember thinking, I'm killing the poor kids. They don't get a poem or they don't get anything. They just get grammar.
It's
tough,
awful sad, you know? That, because there's so like there's, German has such a negative kind of reputation in some ways as being very black and white and square and logical, and it not being an artistic language. My God, some of the poetry is just astonishingly beautiful, and like, you know, the way you can kind of put compound words together, you can make a word that means exactly what you wanted to say in German. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah, my daughter sometimes says to me, Krankenwagen, Krankenhaus. Isn't it great the way they're so descriptive? It just tells you what it is.
Yeah.
And ambulance doesn't tell you anything, and hospital doesn't really help you grasp what's happening.
No. Yeah. Unless you studied Latin and you kind of go back to the roots of the words, which isn't done in schools anymore either.
How's your Latin? We have a special section coming up.
Because I went to a girls' school that didn't offer Latin. I'd have loved to study Latin, actually. It would have been amazing.
Yeah, I think they were offering technical drawing and woodwork instead of Latin and Greek at my school. So we missed out there.
Pity.
But you did go on to be a school teacher.
I did.
Not German.
Not German, no. PE. So all I wanted to ever be from when I was about 11 or 12 was a PE teacher. I was just absolutely sports mad. Like, you know, be kind of doing hockey on a Monday and Wednesday, camogie on a Tuesday and a Thursday. Friday evening I had off, then there was a hockey match Saturday morning, a camogie match Sunday morning, and then there'd be cross country and athletics and stuff in the summer when the GA and the hockey season was over. And I knew I didn't want to ever be in an office job. I couldn't see myself kind of sitting at a computer in an office dealing with documents and stuff. I'd have lost my mind, I think. And being a PE teacher, then, you know, you get to be outdoors quite a lot and stuff. Appealed to me.
And it was a natural flow from school to PE teacher to opera singer.
Yeah, it's funny. Some like people kind of go, oh God, well, that's quite a change. But in hindsight, a lot of the the psychology in terms of performance is the same. So there was stuff that we would have, you know, sports performance psychology that we would have studied in our actual degree is identical to dealing with anxiety and nerves and preparation and skill acquisition and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, you prepare for a football match, you learn your skills on your own, you practice with your team, and you play in front of a crowd. Exact same thing with music. You do your prep, rehearse at your orchestra, and then play your concert.
Okay. What about being fit and, I mean, breathing? And are opera singers supposed to be very fit for lung capacity? Does that come into it?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly helps. I mean, everyone is different and every body is different. And, like, there's such a massive, massive variety of types of voices. When you think of the fact that the person's body itself is the instrument, and that's a combination of the vocal cords and the, you know, core muscles and resonance space and all that kind of stuff, that the spectrum, I don't think any opera singer would say that they need to be a marathon runner, but a basic level of fitness is important. And like, I'd certainly notice now, like the last 3 months, I've had a bit of time on my hands, so I've been keeping fit to kind of keep my kind of head space sane, and I've noticed my singing is so much easier with it, because obviously your instrument is in tune and is kind of flexible and fit, so yeah, it helps.
So you probably couldn't be a heavy smoker and be an opera singer.
There are singers who smoke, and I, like, yeah, tut tut, I can't understand how how they do that to their instrument when it's like the only one they have, and you know, you can't kind of get it replaced or cleaned or
there are
like, it wouldn't be the general thing, but there are singers who smoke.
What about then when it comes to performance, are there differences between performing here in Ireland and performing in Germany?
Yeah, I think the main difference with the two countries is that Germany has this several hundred year old tradition of opera houses being state funded. So, you know, at the time when there was all these different kind of kingdoms, and each one had its own opera house, and the ruler in this one wanted to have a better court opera than the next one, and it became a kind of a point of honour, I guess. So that meant that every municipality had its own opera house, and that was patronised by the state as such, and that became ingrained in the, I suppose, the cultural and political fabric of society as we got to today. Whereas here we don't have that so much. Like from my experience, having been a member of a house in Frankfurt, there was a fabulous sense of it almost been like a football team, but like the public would look forward to seeing the young soprano who's just started, like, you know, doing their first, I don't know, Barbarina in The Marriage of Figaro, and then go, oh, we, oh God, I wonder whether she'll be doing Susanna in 2 years, and then, oh, maybe she'll, you know, kind of develop and stuff. And there was a real kind of involvement and investment in the team of the town and the opera house. And that's starting to happen here, I think, with Irish National Opera now, which is really nice, because the Irish audiences are getting used to seeing Irish singers on stage much more, which is good.
And what about when it comes to the clothing and the dresses that go along with all this? Is that a really important part of it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a lovely perk of the job for having concert wear. Obviously, if you're in an opera production, then there's a costume department in the company that they work out that, and that's not necessarily always a fancy evening dress, but if for concerts, then it's your responsibility to make sure that you look the part, and that's good fun, kind of shopping for those and kind of deciding what dress will suit what occasion and what space and colours and that kind of thing.
And the people who are organising this, do they advise on this? Do they have a sense of how classical they want you to look, or how do they put that across to you?
For concerts, do you mean?
Yeah.
No, that'd usually be pretty much entirely up to the performer. And there's a kind of an unspoken dress code that, I mean, sometimes in a contract you will get gentlemen in tails and ladies in full evening dress, and that will kind of specify it for the bigger concerts. But I mean, for maybe, you know, for an afternoon concert, you might not wear a huge meringue ball gown. It might be a bit much. Like something a bit more demure might be appropriate. But yeah,
and it must need a lot of storage space then.
This is a problem at the moment. Yeah, I have a rack of dresses in my spare bedroom. Well, what will be my spare bedroom now, which need to go in a wardrobe, but the wardrobe has to be kitted out for it first.
And do you bring spare dresses?
Yes, a lovely colleague who any of the opera community listening will know, Cara O'Sullivan, gave me wonderful advice several years ago to always have two dresses with you for a concert, in case a zip goes or you don't realise you've put on a few extra pounds over Christmas or whatever. And she was right. I remember a concert in Germany where my lovely outfit that I had chosen, the zip went 5 minutes before I was due to go on stage. So I was thanking my lucky stars that Cara O'Sullivan had insisted that I always bring a second dress.
I'm going to be more observant now and look at the back and see if I can see safety pins in the back of opera singers' dresses or something.
There has been worse that have happened to colleagues.
When you're singing, is it important that you can speak German so that you can sing in German?
I don't think it's important that you are fluent in the language that you're singing in, but it is imperative that you understand what you are singing when you are singing it. So part of the work of being a singer is when you find out that you're going to be singing a work, that the first kind of protocol would be that you'll take the text of the aria or the song and sit down and translate it so that it makes sense, that you understand the words that you're singing, so you're not, you know, grinning like a maniac while you're singing about, you know, having lost your daughter or lover or whatever. But it certainly helps with pronunciation and kind of style and stuff of the language if you have a little bit of experience in speaking it, but fluency isn't important, no.
And then, because some of the words from operas and that those kind of songs, they come from poets. They were written as poetry first.
Yeah.
So do you enjoy the poetry as a standalone?
Oh, I do. That's one of the amazing things about... So in classical singing, there's three kind of main strands. There's opera, so costumes, you know, orchestra, stage, a story from start to finish. There's oratorio, which is something like Handel's Messiah or Bach Weihnachts Oratorium or... anything that has a sacred text basis. And then there's lieder or song repertoire, and that is identified by it being the text from a poem, and the poet is known to us, and it's usually with piano and singer, and that the composer then sets that text to music. And the piano is a massively important part of the piano is an equal partner, whereas with opera, the orchestra can sometimes be an accompaniment to support the singer, whereas with song recital stuff, the piano and singer are viewed as being 50-50 equal. There's a wonderful Schubert song called Gretchen am Spinnrad, so Gretel at the spinning wheel, and the piano accompaniment, if you listen to it, mimics the spinning wheel turning, and there's a pedal note that keeps repeating, which is, you know, represents her pressing the pedal with her foot, and then there's the right hand has this kind of motif that mimics the wheel, and it's just like the perfect kind of synthesis of text and music, and, you know, then them being greater than the sum of their parts. So,
and do you have a poem that you might read for us?
Yeah, I have. So I recently recorded a CD of Schubert songs with Jonathan Ware at the piano, who is wonderful, and I think our favourite song from that is called Der Winterabend, which is from a poem called simply Winterabend, and it's from Karl Gottfried Ritter von Leitner, who is a really fabulous poet, if any of you want to explore some German poetry. Yeah, I might just start at the beginning and read a little bit and see.
Yeah, give us a verse or two.
Yeah, so Winterabend. Es ist so still und heimlich um mich. Die Sonne ist unter, der Tag entwich. Wie schnell nun heran der Abend graut. Mir ist es recht, sonst ist mir's zu laut. Jetzt aber ist's ruhig. Es hämmert kein Schmied, kein Klempner. Das Volk verlief und ist müd. Und selbst das nicht rassle der Wagenlauf, zog Decken der Schnee durch die Gassen auf.
Wunderschön.
Danke.
But I suppose when you're kind of singing, you become more aware that some of that poetry was written by Goethe or great poets, but they had to actually work with a composer to come up with opera. And they didn't always get on, did they?
No, I mean, that's I suppose for our sensibilities, today it's kind of strange to think like that their socializing and their kind of cultural social circles would have comprised of mates sending each other texts to, you know, critique and stuff, and oh, what do you think about setting this one, and oh, have you got something that I can set music to. For example, one of the songs on that CD is absolutely beautiful. It's called Viola, and it's by Schober is the text, and the story is it's really sad. It's about this little violet who in the spring, just before she blooms a little bit too early and is all excited, and the beginning of the poem describes her putting on her blue dress and her green coat and her diamond dewdrops from the rain and getting ready for her bridegroom, which is spring. And then she suddenly realises it's very cold and she runs off and is scared and alone, and then the spring comes and all the other flowers, and they realise then that she's not there, and the spring sends them all searching, and ultimately, you know, 13 minutes later, they find that. So, like, I actually cried the first two times I, like, read through it and sang through it. It was just, it's so affecting. They find her at the end crumpled up in a little heap, dead. And this was, the relationship between Schober and Schubert kind of soured. And a lot of people kind of say that, oh, that it was kind of quite poignant that the song was set to this text at around the time that their relationship kind of soured. And yeah, I don't know, life imitating art, yeah. I guess, to a certain degree.
There's a kind of level, I suppose, with poetry and maybe with opera that people would consider a little bit kind of elite or high culture, maybe unfortunately, or definitely unfortunately. But I mean, when you're in touch with the German culture, do you come across other elements of it? I mean, are you aware of German film or German television or sports? Does that also creep into where you are?
Yeah, I mean, sports maybe not so much, but one of the things I've been really, really grateful to have, you know, fluent German for the last couple of, well, I suppose last year, is there's an amazing, amazing series called Dark on Netflix, which is in German. I mean, there's English subtitles, and the odd time they speak so fast and not very deutlich that I've had to kind of put on the subtitles just to be like, what did he say? But I think it's always so much more satisfying to experience a piece of art in the language in which it was written. I mean, I'm all for translations and making things accessible, but if you can experience something in the language that it was written in, because, you know, languages, like words themselves, have music in them and have connotations that's what I think one of the wonderful things about language is, that it is kind of built in the culture that it is needed for. Like, you know, that kind of cliche that the Eskimos have 150 different words for snow, where, you know, whereas that wouldn't be relevant in a sunny country. So it's so tied up with the culture and the society as well, that it's you get much more of the in-depth meaning of it. But yeah, but Dark is just, if you're into your sci-fi and weird time travel stuff, it's really good. So I've enjoyed watching that in German.
yeah, it's I wonder if it gives a real insight into a little bit of German culture that you don't always get at, because there is something of the darkness of it that I particularly enjoyed as well.
Have you seen it yet?
Yeah.
It's just I just thought it was so authentic, and like the colours and the production values are all, yeah, just, you really kind of have the feeling of being in German kitchens and sitting rooms, and, like, you know, the family problems that we all kind of experience are universal, I guess.
Coming back again, just you were saying there, I was thinking about a performance in a German opera house and a performance here in Dublin. What happens afterwards? What's it like? When it's over, do you go for drinks, or do people go and celebrate, or how does that work?
I suppose it depends on where you are in the run of shows. Usually for what's called a new production, so if the show hasn't been done before, you'll have a period of up to 6 weeks. So 6 weeks would be the norm in Germany. Sometimes, depending on funding, it can be a little bit less elsewhere. But usually, say, if you have the luxury of having the 6 weeks, you'll do 4 weeks in the rehearsal room, and then 2 weeks in the theatre, and then the orchestra will come, and and everything kind of gets kind of layered on, you know, wigs, costumes, makeup, orchestra, all that kind of stuff. So, and in, again, it depends. So if you're in what's called a festes Mitglied, like a fixed member of an ensemble in a German opera house, you might have an opening night on I don't know, Friday night, and then you might have to also sing another performance the next night. So in that case, obviously, you wouldn't be going out celebrating. But usually you'd go for like dinner afterwards, like a late dinner, because you won't have, if the show starts at 7 or 8 o'clock, you won't have eaten anything directly beforehand, because singing and eating directly, just, you know, you kind of stuff repeating on you.
Can you sing on a hangover?
I have never tried. I don't think I'd want to be honest. I doubt it would work, because if you're hungover, then everything is dehydrated and the vocal cords are so delicate and they're so sensitive to moisture that if they're dried out, then they can't vibrate, and the little mucous membrane is kind of not fully there, then you can do proper damage.
Okay. So when you're socialising then in Germany and in Ireland, do you find that different?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the pub culture here and there is a bit different. There's the, like, I did my initial study in Austria, in Vienna, so that was my first kind of experience of, I suppose, German speaking place, where you go and instead of, you know, going and being in a round with 3 or 4 people and, you know, kind of going to the bar with 20 or 30 quid and been like, right, I'll have one of these. That in Germany and Austria, the waiter comes and you say, oh, I'll have an Apfelwein or, you know, an Weißweinschorle or whatever. And then they make a note on their little settle. And then at the end of the night, they come back and you do, they go around the table and everyone pays exactly what they have ordered themselves and stuff. So then if one person decides to order around in the German way, then that can be kind of jarring, because then if that's not reciprocated, then it shows up the cultural difference.
So have you found yourself very pleased after a performance that you bought everyone a drink and you got the first round and then nothing else happened? It was
once or twice. Yeah, like that's not why you buy a round. So.
Do you have favourite places where you would sing? I mean, are there opera houses or concert halls that are particularly special for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's funny, actually, because somebody else asked me that question a couple of weeks ago in an interview, and I found it actually quite difficult to answer it, because it's mostly been my experience that when I like singing somewhere, it's because the people who are organising the thing are lovely and that the whole experience is lovely, because I suppose once you have a certain level of a decent acoustic and a decent piano, or the professional side of things for the hour and a half, the 2 hours that you're on stage, that's a kind of a little bubble, and you know, you do your mental prep and your physical prep and your artistic prep, and you go on stage, and then everything else becomes invisible. But I suppose here, I love singing Galway. I think Galway audiences are just always so like on your side. They're just really, really lovely, and it's a town that there's such a respect for the arts, even if they're not, you know, if people will kind of go, Ash, there's something on, let's go, like, we'll support it. There's such a brilliant sense of that in Galway.
It's quite a difference from the Frankfurt crowd cheering on their home team and their young star. But as you say, if the appreciation is there and the enthusiasm. What about places where some of the composers that you would really admire had actually worked?
Oh God,
is that a bit special?
Yeah, I mean, I've been to Leipzig twice, and been to the Thomaskirche. Also Bach is my absolute, like, allerheiligste. He is as close to divine as I could possibly imagine anyone ever coming to. So going to see, so he's buried in the, so he was cantor of the Thomaskirche in Leipzig, and that's where he wrote many of his wonderful works for his choir and orchestra there. And he's buried in the church, and you can like literally stand and touch his grave, and I'm even getting emotional now. I got so emotional both times. Like, it's just, there's such a sense of reverence and awe, and just being in that church where such amazing music was written and performed, and we have that legacy thanks to this one man who had a really difficult life. Like, he had a rake of kids, you know, loads of them died. 1600s, 1700s were difficult in terms of health and sanitation and all that kind of stuff. And yet he wrote this absolutely incredible, incredible music. So yeah, so Thomas Kirche in Leipzig is like a pilgrimage. It's amazing.
And are there opera houses, or maybe even are there roles that you would particularly want to sing?
Oh yeah, there's a list. Probably two recent ones that I did that were an absolute dream was we did a big tour of Gluck's, another German composer, Orfeo ed Euridice, which was very well received, and we had a really beautiful kind of alternative take on it, which was really, really satisfying.
Was that on the Abbey here?
It wasn't in the Abbey. It was, where was it on in Dublin? It was on in the Civic in Tala and the Theatre in Dunleary.
Yeah.
I forgot what the name, the Pavilion in Dunleary. And then a couple of years ago, we did a big concert performance of Ariodante by Georg Friedrich Händel. Another, all Germans. and that's, I mean, that's, Ariodante is an absolutely fantastic mezzo trouser role that's just like, it's got all kind of the facets of human emotion in the role. So yeah, those two would be kind of two recent ones that I absolutely loved.
You sing a lot in German. Do you ever sing Osgoelge? Do you ever sing in Irish?
I've actually never sung Osgoelge. Okay. There's a couple of folk songs that have a few couple of fuckle, but no, sadly no. I know a friend of mine, Conor Hanratty, who's a fabulous theatre and opera director, is I think has plans for an Irish version of one of the Greek plays, which whose name has escaped me. So I'd be watching for that with interest. And I know colleagues several years ago in Galway, I think somewhere in Galway, did The Marriage of Figaro, Osgoelge, which I would have loved to sing because there's so much humour in that. I think the Irish language would have been great crack for that. Yeah, it's there should be more music drama in Irish.
I presume there are some sounds that would cross over quite well from German to Irish. That
it's funny, actually. People kind of say, so any of my kind of foreign colleagues, when they hear me speak, you know, if there's another Irish person there and you kind of start blabbing Osgoelge for, you know, but to show people like what Irish is, because I always find it really funny that they don't understand that it's not just English with an Irish accent. And they go, oh, it's really like Russian. I'm kind of always like, what? But the dark L's and the dark O's are quite they're quite similar to much more similar actually to Russian pronunciation than any other kind of singing language, I guess.
Maybe to wrap up a little bit, to bring it back around again, after your years living in Germany and Austria and after your exposure to obviously lots and lots of German music and stuff, do you feel a little bit German? Do you feel as a part of you has become a bit Germanized?
Yeah, absolutely. And like my friends will kind of slag me that I've gotten too German. No,
How does your German side manifest itself, I suppose?
It's made me an awful lot more organised than I used to be, which is a really, really, really good thing. Yeah, I think there's the thing about, you know, putting the verb at the end of the sentence when you've got split infinitives and stuff, that like German stops you just by the actual Denkweise, like the way that you think. It stops you being really super spontaneous in potentially a good way, that you have to plan out what it is you want to say so you don't blurt out stuff. I always kind of think it's funny that, you know, that someone could be like a serial killer and that they're going to tell you that they're going to kill you, but you wouldn't actually know until the very end of the sentence. But yeah, and there's another kind of funny phenomenon that's happened in the last couple of years, which I absolutely love. I have lots of good friends who are German, and I, you know, we kind of FaceTime, and my singing teacher actually is an Irish mezzo-soprano, Alison Browner, who has lived in Germany for the past 30-odd years, and you know, she had her family there and had a big career in Europe. But, I mean, she's fluent in German as well, but when I speak with her or with friends of mine who have excellent English and are obviously German, that you can kind of switch between the two languages in the same conversation, and if you find a word that's more passant, appropriate in the flow of what you're saying in one language, you can just, you know, pepper the sentence with both languages, and it just, because I know lots of people who are bilingual talk about that you the word for something disappears. You can see it in your head and you kind of go, oh, you know, that blue thing that with the wet stuff in it, like a bottle of water, yeah, that the word disappears. So that kind of stops that, and then you kind of get this lovely kind of tapestry of two languages that it's much more expressive than in either language on its own. So I actually love that.
Yeah, yeah. I find sometimes if I'm going to do an interview in one language and I'm preparing for another language, I find it quite unnerving because I can't find all the words and stuff. And sometimes if I'm chatting to a friend of mine who's an Irish speaker, I'll squelch it naturally, and then we sit down to do the interview in English, it's really disconcerting.
But there's really interesting stuff actually written about, because I read up a bit about this over the past couple of years, that languages they're stored in different parts of your brains. It's not like you have like languages in one section, you kind of like have the data bank for all the words. Like English is in one physical place, German is in one physical place, and they're totally distinct from each other. Like I can't say the number doesn't exist. I don't have the number anymore. But when I had my German phone number, I had memorized it in German, and I cannot still, for the life of me, say it in English. I have to say it in German and write it down, and then say it in English.
Yeah, yeah. 26, 47, 39. Isn't that you read it the different ways, the German number? 21, 24.
2, 7, 7, 1, 3, 7, 0.
Oh, you're saying just numbers. You're not.
Yeah,
reading
I had.
It.
Yeah, no, I had just numbers. It was just the I had it memorized in German, and I could not say it in English.
Yeah.
Like I had to translate it from German.
Yeah,
it's mad.
And I did say we were going to wrap up, but that was ages ago. So, just to wrap up, back again to singing and stuff. If people weren't that familiar with opera, what would you recommend that would be something that they should listen to? That would be something that would be a really nice introduction.
Oh God, that's a really difficult question. I would say Mozart is usually a safe bet. It depends actually on what your kind of interest is.
Would you say to start with Wagner's Ring to get into 16 hours of Wagner or something to get you started?
The thing is, maybe not 16 hours of Wagner, but the overture to Tannhäuser is absolutely unbelievable. And I'm not a huge fan of Wagner at all. But if you're Googling it on YouTube, there's Barenboim recording of the Tannhäuser overture, which is just astonishing. It's absolutely astonishing. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant recording. And much better than several of the other ones that would be kind of floating. And it's just a good example of how a really excellent conductor and an excellent orchestra, that a piece of music can be something completely different than if someone doesn't know what they're doing with it. It depends. I mean, Mozart is usually a fairly safe bet because he is someone who captures the human condition and its, flaws and charms in a really transparent, and it's almost so simple, but when you analyse it, then it's actually really really difficult to kind of to recreate that. Something like The Marriage of Figaro is wonderful. It's there's kind of something for everyone. There's humour in it, and there's kind of marital strife and that kind of stuff.
Some of the songs that you sing, are they Schubert songs? I was looking up YouTube and I was come across that Ganymede.
The
Goethe poem. You sing that beautifully.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
That's my recommendation.
Oh, very good.
Rather than yours. Okay, Sharon, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Vielen Dank.
Vielen Dank. And Mille Buiches.
Gormile Machagut.
And best of luck.
Yeah. Slán.
Slán an ish.
Thanks.